So we'll just take a minute to revive our motivation using refuge in bodhicitta. Sanghe chodam sanghe chunam lai janchu padu dani kapsuchi dagi chenyan ki pe sonam ki drola penche sanghe jupasho Sanghe chodam sanghe chunam la janchu padu dani kapsuchi dagi chenyan ki pe sonam ki Rola penje sanghe drupa sho sanghe chodam sanghe chodam la janchu padu dani kapsuchi dagi chenyan gi pe sonam gi Rola penje sanghe drupa sho. Okay. So before the break, we did a meditation looking at the impermanence of thoughts, and we started it with a nice little bit longer than usual body relaxation. So how did that go for you folks? Did you have any questions or impressions that you felt comfortable sharing? Could you get into an observational mode with your own thoughts, or did it feel like you just got sucked into them? Yeah, Christina.
Hi. I wanted to ask, do you have any advice for the times when you are feeling quite sleepy? Try to focus on the nostrils instead of the belly or this, or even open slightly my eyes. But I tend to struggle with sleepiness rather than too many thoughts. So is there any advice for that?
Yeah, definitely. The first advice is common sense, which is, are you chronically sleep deprived anyway? And then as soon as you slow down, the sleep just hits you because your body is saying, oh good, she stopped, let's sleep. So it could be that you're just genuinely tired, and it's better if you have a nap and then do a meditation after your nap. So that's the common sense advice. Sometimes we don't even notice how tired we are until we stop, because we're just so on the go, at least mentally on the go. So that's one thing to just check in with, like, are you getting enough sleep? The other one is, if it has nothing to do with your body and you're actually getting plenty of sleep, you're fine. But as soon as you start to meditate, you're just like, you know, nodding or just kind of going into like a hazy concentration where you're like half awake, but also you're kind of like foggy, you know, you're not like asleep, but you're just kind of like, you know, and that's really common. And, you know, you start with the basics, make sure you're sitting up straight, focus more at the nostrils, have your eyes open a little bit, as you mentioned. And if that's not working, there's, you know, some acupressure points you can try. Like if you pinch your pinkies, sometimes that can encourage some wakefulness. If that is not the issue, it could be that there's some real resistance in your mind to the process, which might be a gateway to some excellent wisdom. Or it could be something, you know, neurotic or traumatic or something in your past that doesn't want you to settle down and still and look at stuff because it's too overwhelming. So the wisdom that might be there is maybe just, I'm not sure exactly what I'm supposed to do, but I know I could use a little holiday from my train of thought. So because I'm not totally sure on the instructions, I'm just gonna go into a haze, and that's relaxing, and oh well. So that could be a wisdom where you're like, I'm not actually sure what I'm doing. Meditation sounds so simple, but then when you actually do it, you realize even focusing on the breath is actually harder than it sounds. You know, you're like, okay, I know that I'm breathing. So what? So just do that. All right. You know, and you're kind of like, what's happening? Or you're focused on watching the thoughts, and you know, at first you're trying to maybe make thoughts to watch, or you have so many thoughts, it's a blur, or it's like static or intriguing, or you're reminded of things you've been putting off, or lots of stuff can happen. So if before you even start, you think, I'm just going to be curious and try, And it doesn't have to be successful. The best meditation is not having distractions, but choosing not to indulge them. So whenever you notice a haze or a sleepiness or an intriguing distraction, you just ask yourself, what was the instruction? The instruction was just watch the breath. Okay, I'm gonna just come back to just watch the breath. Okay, and you last for 3 seconds, 5 seconds, and then you start to drift again. And you just want an awake enough mindfulness that says, come back, it's okay, come back, it's okay. Just like you were, you know, helping your little niece or nephew learn how to walk, you know, and they fall over, it's okay, stand up, try again, it's okay, you know, because it is a new skill. You know, we do know how to be focused and relaxed in a couple of scenarios in our life, but usually stress is associated with focus and sleep is associated with relaxation. So it's a new association to like break focus free from stress and break relaxation free from sleep and then be focused and relaxed at the same time. It's like a new association. So it's going to take a little bit of just come on back, come on back. And even if it's every couple of seconds and you can only do that, come back for 5-10 minutes, it actually is training you. So don't feel like it's a failure if you get sleepy. It's only a quote failure if you give up and give into it. And if you, you know, fully can't help but give into it, probably there's more going on, like you actually need more sleep, or there's some deep stuff happening in your life that needs some talking out or some sitting with that's unrelated to meditation. And it's just a bit overwhelming. And your mind is like, not now, we're going to the sleepy place, you know, so it could be that. But that's the thing, you know, you guys don't feel like having distractions is bad. You will have distractions for a very long time. It's about not giving in. You know, you're watching your train of thought and then you have an interesting train of thought or you remember something fun or something unfortunate and then you just give in. If it's important, you can come back to it. You know, you say, that was an interesting point. I'm going to look back into that in 10 minutes after I finish my meditation. The discipline is training in not allowing the drift. The drift will happen, but you're not allowing it to continue. Yeah. So it's interesting because sometimes you'll feel like the meditation was not very successful because you were so distracted and you had to keep coming back and coming back. But after the meditation, you actually feel really calm and really clear. Yeah. Do you ever have that? Like the meditation itself was a bit of work and a little bit of a struggle, but after the meditation, you actually feel pretty good. Does that sometimes happen to folks? You know, which is showing it's going in the right direction, right? It's like for some people, if you exercise after the exercise, you feel a nice endorphin rush or a peaceful, relaxed feeling or the post-workout. You know, some people feel horrible after they exercise, but you know, it's that kind of similar thing with meditation where you can kind of gauge, was I going in the right direction based on how you feel afterwards? Yeah. So take that more as, was it a good meditation? You feel a bit calmer afterwards, a bit more centered. It was going in the right direction. Yeah. Yeah. Any other thoughts from that meditation or questions in general? Yeah. Tara?
Question. Focusing on the mind, I have been practicing shamatha meditation, and we'll focus on the breathing for 2 sessions and then focus on the mind. And there was a comment that was made about, you know, about your thoughts and you're saying how you're going to be an observer, you know, be an observer of them. And there was a comment that I liked that I haven't really followed up on. Seeing your thoughts as a sense, in a way, like we have our 5 senses that are 6. So like our thoughts are a 6th sense. So in a way, when we're observing the thoughts, when they come up, in a way, at some point when I observe, I can obviously see I'm thinking about the same things. I mean, the patterns are the same. Okay. It's the same. I'm not like creating anything different. I'm doing the exact same thing. So I thought it, and I didn't know Anyway, I was just kind of taught this kind of idea of seeing your thoughts as kind of a sense. And then I kind of took it as it's kind of like it's a pattern. So then I guess I would be trying to observe that. I mean, someone, people comment, like someone in the chat box, seeing the thoughts float away, the mind like a sky. I get that too, the clouds and stuff. But yeah. I think this thought pattern, seeing thoughts as a sense, is that a way to kind of detach from them and let them go?
Well, it can be, and it sounds like it's going generally in the right direction. You know, technically we would say there are six primary consciousnesses or six main minds, depending on your translator.
Right.
The five related to the senses and the one related to the mind. The one related to the mind, the mental sense consciousness, the primary consciousness, has within it many, many mental factors or states of mind or conceptions and thoughts that are moving and changing. So we would say the main minds are sensorial in that sense, and that the mental factors are more movements within that or as a part of that or that direct that. But that's kind of a technical minds and mental factors conversation. But if just so you know, if you say that to a Geshe, they're going to immediately tidy you up. But for our purposes, I think that the way you're describing it works pretty well. And I think that recognizing patterns is really helpful. I guess the thing about if it's shamatha, if it's single-pointed concentration, is not to fall into the trap of describing your experience to yourself while you're having it. Yeah, you can describe your experience to yourself after and kind of do a like a post meditation reflection of like, what just happened? You know, like, oh, I was thinking about those greatest hits of thoughts. Once again, my greatest hits, you know, my favorite memories, my worst failures, fun songs and TV shows I like. Yeah, whatever.
So right, that observing part, you're not describing your experience to yourself. So that's the trick problem is you're distancing, but then you're observing, but then not a describing.
So exactly.
Yourself, not to then fall into something else. Okay. I mean, I know it's steps and this takes time, but anyway.
If you do describe it to yourself, just don't elaborate or go too far with it. You know, you could be like, oh yeah, thinking about dinner again. Anyway, watch.
Right.
You know, anyway,
just let it go again. Let it go. You're supposed to let them go. Anyway, that's what, of course, the meditation reminded me of. It was lovely. Thank you.
Yeah, good. Good. And I think for all of us, that remembering of when it's single pointed, you're not agreeing or disagreeing with your thoughts. Right? You're not saying that was a significant thought, that was an insignificant thought, that was a good one, that was a bad one. You're not chasing, you're not suppressing, you're just keep come back. When it's analytical meditation, you're switching gears and you're using a different skill set in meditation, in analytical meditation. And like the meditation leader might say, anger is never justified because anger is the wish to harm. Then you can say, do I agree or disagree? You know, it's a premise for you to play with. So in analytical meditation, you go, do I agree with that? Logically, experientially, do I agree with that? If I agree with that, how does that impact my daily life? You are exploring it. The discipline in analytical meditation then is to not become tangential. So if the meditation is about cultivating patience and overcoming anger, and you have an interesting thought about loving kindness or compassion, it may be related, but if it's not related, you come back. Yeah, so it's a discipline of staying within the topic that you've chosen, because otherwise you reinforce your habit of kind of free associating and drifting and, you know, kind of relating things. And that's just kind of your regular train of thought anyway. So how is that much different than meditating, right? So in both cases, the discipline is whatever you've chosen to meditate on, do that. Even if something brilliant and dharmic comes up to your mind, for that moment, stay with what you've chosen. And I think, you know, it makes a kind of logic to us to understand why, right? Because if you are meditating on compassion and suddenly want to meditate on wisdom, that's actually another version of your mind chasing entertainment and doing this chasing, grasping thing. It's saying, oh, this was okay, but now that I've tried it, let's do this. Now that I've tried it, let's do this. And it just keeps that habit of chasing in our mind. So even though wisdom is good, that's not what you decided. You decided you're doing this, so do this. Yeah. And then your next session, you can do wisdom if you want to. But it is important to have like this gentle discipline of holding yourself to your own choices, even if only for one session, within that session, a very gentle, definitive kind of discipline. Does that make sense? And it's very natural for us, once the mind settles down and starts to get a bit clearer, for really brilliant ideas to occur to us, right? Really important connections, really good associations, seeing things about our relationships, all sorts of really brilliant things will come to us. And in a way, it's a good sign, but don't indulge that. If you feel like it's too important, you can do like a preliminary meditation, which is not really meditating. You can do a preliminary, which is, how about I just sit quietly and see what my thoughts are doing and let them do whatever they want for 5 minutes. And I'm not meditating and I'm not directing them. I'm just winding down after a big day, or I'm winding down after a big life, right? And just let your thoughts think and do whatever they want for a bit. And then it's like you kind of consciously rein it in and then direct it. So that can be useful, like especially at the end of the day, if you've been at work or something and you want to meditate when you come home from work, you might be a bit too buzzy to really sit well the second you get home. So you might want to just have a glass of water, have a think, and just kind of for a bit and then sit. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah. Any other meditation thoughts? In terms of this text, you know, after the class, I think it's useful to look at all the verses, whether we get into them or not. There's tons of commentaries in English on this text. There's really technical scholarly ones. There's really everyday life accessible ones. There's a whole bunch. So there's plenty of follow-up material. But I think it's useful to read through the whole thing and then maybe pick one and kind of use that one as your mindfulness motivation for the next week. Yeah, because if you really reinforce one, then you can drill down and get deeper and deeper with it and just kind of see the influence it has on your daily life. And it might be you stay with that one forever, or it might be that you cycle through them and like once a week change. Yeah, but that's a way to kind of take a practice that you've learned about intellectually in a course to your daily life practice and start weaving it in, is to just really gently stay with one piece for a while, rather than getting overwhelmed and feeling like you need to read the whole thing every day or understand the whole thing. Just chunk it out. Yeah. And if it doesn't sit well with you, you can pick a different one, but it's a useful practice to kind of cycle through a text like this and come to deeper and deeper connection with the verses in a really gradual way. Because once you understand it intellectually, then it has to digest. Yeah, and it has to kind of gently come into your actual experience. And you need to hear the sound of the words in your own voice, rather than my voice or the voice of the author. It has to be your voice. Okay, so we'll do a few more verses and just see what you think about them. Let's see. So this one is a bit tricky, but good, which is avoiding unsuitable friends whose company creates conditions unfavorable to your progress. So the practice of all the bodhisattvas is to avoid destructive friends in whose company the three poisons of the mind grow stronger. And when we engage less and less in study, reflection, and meditation, so that love and compassion fade away until they are no more. So this is shifting the emphasis of our mental energy. So you're not giving up on anyone, but you're still creating boundaries that are healthy with those who have a negative influence on us. So it's really having that type of humility and self-awareness that knows, are you being influenced or are you the influencer? is the bad behavior of people and, I don't know, the divisiveness or the destructiveness or the criticalness of the people around you, does it get to you and make you into that? Or are you connected enough to your practice that you can kind of stay balanced with it and influence them to upgrade the content of their speech and behaviors? So for us as beginners, you know, we might be very well behaved with other Dharma students. You know, when we're with our Dharma friends, we might be polite and patient and very accommodating and forgiving and not be divisive. But as soon as we're with our non-Dharma friends, we're so harsh and gossipy and divisive, and we rant and rave about politics with no kind of idea of collaboration and solutions focus. We're just thinking, those bad guys, they're so whatever, you know. But then we're with our Dharma friends and we talk about nice, lovely Dharma things, right? It's common. And it doesn't mean you need to like avoid people in a way that punishes them. Right? You're not withholding affection. You're not blocking people. You're consciously not maintaining relationships that aren't healthy. Yeah, but you're leaving the door open because sometimes they might be healthy, or sometimes the people might actually upgrade a little bit themselves. But you're honest enough with yourself to know, I can be in my best ethics, but only with really conducive conditions at my level. And as soon as I'm with these other people, I do things I'm embarrassed about later. Someday, I might have the mental stability to return to them and not be swayed. But right now is not maybe that time for all of them. So who is it I need to gently disengage from? And I don't actually have to tell them unless they ask or unless it seems necessary. You can just gently not give energy. Some relationships can just kind of die a natural death or can just gradually drift. There doesn't have to be a famous final scene where you say, here are all the ways we are not in alignment, hair toss, goodbye. You know, you don't have to do that. It's not mature, right? And it's not useful. You can just let it be. Yeah. Maybe you have old friends from school that you hang on to out of some sense of obligation, but actually when you're together, you're bad influence on each other. Cherish the memories, let it go. Right. How does that sit with you though? Do you feel a little pang or a little worry about that? Or does it feel skillful to do that? Or do you feel some kind of resistance? You know, and it's easy enough to talk about, right? But sometimes the relationship's not so tidy as that. Yeah, Christina.
I was wondering, shouldn't you use those circumstances to practice patience, for example?
In theory, right? Yeah. And this is the question, is that can you? If you can, then do. This is kind of looking at the relationships where it's really a bit too tangled and toxic for you to have the mental space to do that. So theoretically what you're saying, 100%, we could keep everything in our life exactly as it is and not change anything except for our mental attitude. That's like advanced training, right? And someday we'll be able to do that. We can live in any kind of life with any kind of people and our mind will remain clear and contented and patient and kind. At our level, there are some people who are generally a negative influence, but it doesn't pull us off track, and we might actually kind of help lift them. But there are also maybe people in our life that we are worse and, you know, badly behaved as soon as we're with them. So, you know, who is that or what is the conditions of that? It might be only if you're drunk, right? So then don't be drunk with them. You know, maybe there's some people when you're drunk, you're all kind of huggy and cuddly and talk about world peace. All right, do that, whatever. It's your business. But there might be people that, you know, when certain intoxicants are involved or certain activities are involved, you both go down together. And how is that good for anybody? So it's a tricky one. And I, you know, advise you to really think about it deeply, about what's the skillful way to disengage from some relationships that is not blaming them. Yeah. Because they just haven't met the same resources and supports and tools as you. They're not less than you. They're not worse than you. As is shown by the fact that when you're together, you're just as bad as each other, right? But you have met something that can elevate your mind. And we don't want to miss that window of opportunity. You know, death is coming. When we're on our deathbed, will we think, I wish I had spent more time speaking critically and gossiping about people. I wish I had spent more time playing endless video games. I wish I'd watched a lot more TV series. You know, will you think that on your deathbed? You know, I wish I'd wasted more time and eaten more junk food. I really, really wish I had done that. Yeah, no. You're going to think, I wish I had built more depth and meaning into my life and relationships. You know, those are the kind of regrets that we probably will have. And we can avoid if we kind of get into now, what do I need to do now to die happily with a peaceful mind that says whatever comes next, whether it's a next life, whether it's whatever, whether they're lights off and it's all finished. I feel like this was a good life with kindness that touched some kind of truth. And I'm leaving behind a legacy of kindness in the people that I leave behind, some sort of friendship and insight in the people who have been in my life. You know, then you think, okay, with the conditions I had, not too bad, off I go, you know? So that's kind of the question to ask yourself is when you see yourself with those friends and then you think about how you'll view it as an older person, as a person on your deathbed, as someone who is trying to advance in some way, do you feel like that was time well spent? You know. Okay. So there was a question in the chat, and Kevin was saying that sometimes uncomfortable at social events, you know, it just feels like a waste of time. And I think certainly that can be true for sure. And then Caitlin was saying, I find this more skillful to do. I've been able to do this over the last couple of years and recognize more unsuitable relationships. A few years ago, I would have a big blowout ending, whereas now more gradually removing myself away without any discussion, and that feels more natural. Yeah. And I guess, you know, the only danger here is that you start focusing too much on the activity and not on what your attitude is. So for example, if you're visiting your old relative and they want to talk about the footy and the weather and this and that, for them, those are things that are comforting. And if they're not actively destructive, support them. Talk about the weather, talk about the footy, whatever. Right? It's not about the content. It's about your mental attitude. So, you know, don't get kind of like on your high horse and I don't talk about things like that anymore. They're irrelevant, you know, right? It's like what is kind for them is to see if you can talk about what interests them, especially if it's the productive things that interest them. You feel the distinction. So that's the only danger when you start to gently disengage from harmful relationships. You fall into the trap of thinking it's more about the content than the attitude. It's about the attitude. So talk about the weather if you want to talk about the weather. Okay. So then the relying on the spiritual teacher, this is the guru verse. The practice of all the bodhisattvas is to cherish spiritual friends by regarding them as even more precious than one's body. Since they are the ones who will help us to rid us of all our faults and make our virtues grow ever stronger, just like the waxing moon. So this is shifting away from destructive friends to constructive friends. Yeah. And the most constructive friend being the spiritual teacher or the spiritual friend, but also talking about community. So seeking a spiritual mentorship to collaborate with our inner guru and creating healthy relationships with those who are a positive influence on us. So you're making an effort basically. You're making an effort in the friendships that are healthy. You're seeking them out. You're seeking activities that build them. You're finding ways to spend more time together. And with the guru, you're recognizing that it is mainly their teachings and the directness of a human relationship giving those teachings that is helpful for you. They are not the source of your wisdom. They are the mouthpiece for wisdom. It's your choice whether to hear it or not. It's your choice how you integrate it and how you take it to heart. So the inner guru is just as important as the outer guru. There has to be a collaborative aspect to this relationship. It shouldn't be passive. And probably not many folks fall into this trap, but occasionally people will, in a way, view the guru-disciple relationship as a way to avoid responsibility for their choices. And they'll start saying, they'll kind of get a bit parental about it or something like, is it okay if I dot, dot, dot? And it's like, well, if it's positive and you have the time, energy, and resources, why are you asking the teacher? Just go do it. If you're genuinely checking because you're not sure, excellent, do that. Do you see what I mean? Like some folks are, in a way, ready to give up responsibility for their life. They're like, take my life, it's too hard, you make the decisions. That's not the way to have a guru-disciple relationship. Sometimes when you hear old students talk about their teacher, it will sound like they're doing that. Like, oh, I was gonna do this, but Rinpoche told me not to. Do you ever hear this? Yeah. Oh, Rinpoche said blah, 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 blah. So I'm gonna do that, you know? And it gets kind of a, I don't know, kind of a willful, snooty, dad said kind of energy to it. Yeah. And sometimes it's coming from a genuine place of deep respect. And sometimes it's virtue signaling, right? Sometimes it's, look at me, I have a fancy guru and everything I do is amazing and special because they told me, you know, and it's a little bit obnoxious, right? So just kind of know that that can happen to any of us. And even if your teacher is giving you specific practice advice, it's best not to broadcast that to other people, unless it makes sense to do so because they're doing something similar. But that kind of like shine of showing off, it's not helpful for you, you know? And it often can alienate new people because they're like, oh, I don't have that relationship with Lama Zopa Rinpoche, for example, or His Holiness. Does that mean I don't have a relationship with him? Does that mean I can't see him as my teacher? Oh, we've never even spoken face to face. I just love his classes. Oh no. And you know, it can actually kind of disempower new people if you're too kind of showing off about the closeness of your own teacher relationship as well. So those are just kind of things to keep in the back of your mind, because all of us, if we want to, could see His Holiness the Dalai Lama as our root guru. He said, that's fine, that's okay. He gives empowerments to thousands of people. We can do that. That means that when we're listening to teachings, we're listening to the teachings of His Holiness, whoever the source is. We're like listening for his brand of wisdom and his way of articulating things that touches our heart. Yeah, we're listening for him in everything. We're looking for him in books. We're trying to hear that style of resonance. And that doesn't mean you ever have to meet him face to face, because his mind is that expansive. You're fine. He's holding you, you're holding him. It's fine. As soon as you decide it, it's fine. But if you're talking about your home Geshe, you know, the Geshe at your local Dharma center or the resident teacher at your local Dharma center, those relationships are more frequent and more face-to-face. And there's a lot more negotiation and discussion that needs to happen before the relationship is formalized. You need to know each other better. So there's, you know, levels of teacher and levels of relationship and styles that are different, but it all can work together really beautifully. Any questions about the guru stuff? I know it can be a little complicated, and it becomes even more complicated if you practice Highest Yoga Tantra, but maybe no one here does, so maybe that's not relevant here, but or a couple of you do, but not everyone.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
I thought I would go ahead and ask. I don't, because I do hear it often when I go to the meditations, when I'm meditating the group stuff online, you know, think of your root guru. And I mean, I'm just contemplating this for a long time. So who is? And then I do hear, you know, like you said, you can think of His Holiness as your root guru. And then I hear Him say, and if you don't have one, think of. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I'm just kind of like waiting.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure if I completely understand. I think sometimes during a meditation, I might connect and think of maybe my teacher, my, you know, whom I took vows with, or then another time I might think, you know, go ahead, I'll think of, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha or something. But I'm kind of just like wandering around, which is okay for me, right? But because you had at least the question, the topic here, I just wonder what more you might say.
In the beginning, in the beginning, it really does help to pick a person. Yeah. And if you already have taken vows from someone, they're one of your people, what you can choose. And you can think many into one, like all the Buddhas in Shakyamuni Buddha, all of your teachers into this one teacher that you took vows from.
Now that you're saying it,
But what you're really doing is you're trying to train an aspect of your listening ability, right? So you're using one relationship to kind of get yourself this ability to listen deeply for wisdom. Have you ever heard in the Zen tradition, they say, see everyone as your teacher, right? In the Tibetan tradition, we're working up to seeing everyone as our teacher by picking one teacher first as our gateway to hear wisdom, right? So again and again, the advice is hear all teachings as personal advice. Even if it's a general class to 1,000 people, try to hear it as if it is specifically for you. And when you meet who is someone who is one of your root gurus, it will feel like personal advice. Like it will land like, wow, they are talking to me. And the person next to you is like, yeah, me too. You know, but it like it has that feeling of, wow, you are talking to me, which probably means the karmic connection is suitable to build on. Yeah. But really what you're training is your deep listening. And when you're good at hearing wisdom from one person, then you can start hearing it from more people and more people and more people. And you can start to hear the fact that the Buddhas are shouting wisdom at you with so much love all the time, but there's not enough receptor sites in you to hear it all the time.
Right. Because you can hear it from many, that wisdom from many teachers. So
definitely. But it's kind of like, how does it land? Does it land as, oh, that's good advice in general? Or does it land as, oh, I need to change some things. Need to change some things, you know? Yeah. Yeah, Ladan?
Yes. About the guru and root guru, all this, for example, when I take my vows, it was not a lineage, it was kind of more general, mind only school. Oh. And then I listened to Dharma from Japanese Zen and then Vajrayana, and each time there was something to compare with, sometimes the things are like newly explained to me, and I heard that before, but it was land on me and talk to me. But all of these schools, like, is there anything bad that you compare to everything to everything and you pick or because sometimes you're old enough, you need to choose one and stick to them.
You do need to choose one tradition, but that doesn't mean you can't listen to the other traditions and use the other traditions to augment your understanding of your own tradition. We don't want to be sectarian, right? The thing is, the Buddha taught all of it. He taught all of it. Why does it sound so different school to school? Because people have different learning styles and different affinities and different connections. So they need to hear the Dharma coming from many different angles, maybe even hear the Dharma from a different religion. So our one tradition doesn't have the copyright on truth, right? The Buddha didn't make the truth. He just revealed the truth. He's not the only one, right? There have been many Buddhas. There will be many Buddhas. So what you're looking for is your spiritual home. Yeah, that feeling of spiritual home and spiritual family and connection in that way. And then you can go visit other people's houses and other people's teachers and really enjoy them and let it enrich you. You know, sometimes the, like, for example, the Nyingma tradition sometimes explains things from a slightly more poetic way that can be very inspiring. Whereas our tradition, the Geluk tradition, is very scholastic and concrete and lists, which helps keep you very tidy and organized and disciplined. But sometimes you're like, I could use a little bit of, I don't know, warmth, you know, and, you know, the Geshe's are very like, snap out of it, you know? And so, you know, you might need a little bit of like, I don't know, lovey, squishy something, you know, like I'm probably going to go to a Native American powwow probably in a few weeks, just because I love them and I feel inspired by them. I am not Indian, right? No. I am not, you know, I'm not taking on any of that tradition, but I can hear truth from many sources, right? So Buddhism is fundamentally non-sectarian. And if people are sectarian, that's not Buddhism, that's their misunderstanding. So you're looking for your spiritual home, but you're not saying the other homes are bad, because they're not. They're just a different style.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Kevin, did you have a question?
I wanted to share something. When I retired at 66, I actually lived with the forest monks for 6 months. Although they're Hinayana, I was able to, you know, do my own Mahayana practice within their system. And I learned as much from them as they learned from me.
Yeah.
And also, when I lived in Mae Sot, we had a Chinese Zen group who taught in English. So I've done Zen retreats and got a lot from that as well. So I think people should not just focus, but just be very careful, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, when I went to India with the Thai people, I was actually given the Hinayana prayer book with the English translation. And some of those prayers are very, very useful. Like they do one on the reflections of the Buddha, which is like 14 lines. And it's a beautiful meditation practice that I've developed using that.
Yeah, I think that's a really skillful approach. It's basically knowing that the different traditions will use terminology differently, and the way they express the view of the emptiness of inherent existence is in various degrees of subtlety. So it's easy to get confused. That's why it is good to kind of centralize on one for a while before you start kind of augmenting. So it's a little bit like in the beginning, shop around, look around until you find home, then stay home for a while until you get grounded. And then you can shop around a little bit and kind of weave different elements into your core practice. Does that make sense?
That's why I did the tenants course with Venerable George.
Yeah, that's so a great idea.
That way I know what their various traditions believe, and I can actually then talk to those people in their own terms as well.
Yeah, yeah. Studying tenets is a great idea if you've got the mental space for it. Definitely. Yeah. So looking at the different schools of thought, you see that the Buddha taught who was in front of him. You know, he didn't just blast people with the same teaching again and again. He looked at who he was talking to. Who was his audience? What did they need to hear to go the next level higher or deeper than they were before? Which is really the approach we want to have with folks, right? We're not going to tell them the most advanced, highest philosophical view that we understand. We're going to look at who's in front of us and what do they need. And what they might need is silence or an invitation to articulate their own wisdom. And sometimes, if they're open, they might ask, how do Buddhists view difficult people or difficulty? Then you might share a couple things, way less than all of the, you know, don't info bomb them, right? Just kind of throw a few ideas, see how they land. But really like hands off and wait to be asked, you know? Yeah. Because we don't want to be missionaries, do we? That never ends well. Okay. So a few more verses, then we'll meditate. So the practice of all the bodhisattvas is to take refuge in the three jewels, since they will never fail to provide protection for all who call upon them. For whom are the ordinary gods of this world ever capable of helping, as long as they themselves are trapped within samsara's vicious cycle? So this is the explanation of how to rely and on what, and taking safe direction from, and how to be motivated by. So the three jewels are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, who we are to view as the doctor, the medicine, and the nurses, which means that we are in some way unwell. We're unwell because of our afflictions and our confusion. We're not bad, we're unwell. And that's a really important distinction, which means that we have the potential for wellness, which means that we have a fundamental ability for health. So you're kind of touching in, I could be healthier and stronger than I am if I recognize my illness and turn to a doctor to see what the issue is. And they might give me a good prescription, but it's only going to work if I take the medicine. And the medicine is the Dharma itself. And when you take it and integrate it, it makes you healthy and it protects you. But what is it that's actually protecting you? It's your own mind's relationship with these ideas. You know, you're not being force-fed wellness. It's that you've been offered a technique which then brings out the wellness. And then the Sangha relatively are like monks and nuns, generally, maybe even the whole community itself. Ultimately, Arya Bodhisattvas who have realized emptiness directly. But what we're looking at here is folks that are maybe not finished with their path, but can help you understand dosage and side effects and pacing and say, if you try this, go slowly. If you try this, full speed ahead. You know, be gentle in your approach to the Dharma so that it has the chance to take root. Yeah. So this is the verse on refuge. So that's the sections that we've been through. And then we have a very brief section on the initial scope or the small scope, and then the medium scope. And then the whole rest of the text is about full-on bodhisattva work. But it's actually really important to look at these introductory stages, and then it's almost easy to connect with bodhicitta. So we have the first part, beings of lesser capacity, which means that their scope of their goal is smaller. They're aiming for a good future life. Then we have path for beings of a medium capacity, or they have a medium scope in their goal. And their idea is ending samsara, so cutting cyclic existence, going on to achieve nirvana, but not yet full Buddhahood. So for us, we might be like small scope practitioners, but have a great scope aspiration. So we might not be able to practice the great scope fully yet at our level, but we're aiming for it, and we're practicing these smaller scope practices with that mentality. So verse 8 says, the practice of all the bodhisattvas is never to commit a harmful act, even though not to do so might put one's own life at risk. For the sage himself has taught how negative actions will ripen into manifold miseries of the lower realm so difficult to endure. So the heart of this is, if you want to continue your spiritual path in your next life, right now, ethics. Ethics, 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 the ethics of non-harmfulness. So it's not like a moralistic goody two shoes kind of ethics. It's this proactively non-harming, if that makes sense. Yeah, actively not harming. Then the second one, or verse 9, the practice of all the bodhisattvas is to strive towards the goal, which is the supreme state of changeless, everlasting liberation. Since all the happiness of the three realms lasts but a moment and is quickly gone like dewdrops on blades of grass. So it's saying that being obsessed with this life and being obsessed with samsara is kind of a fantasy, because you're just kind of adding cushions to your prison cell and redecorating a trap. And isn't it better to get out of the whole thing? That all of the activities of samsara have an illusory aspect to them, and that they all change anyway. So, you know, death's not going to wait for us to finish our projects. Many of our projects will fade in 5 to 10 years after we die. What's the project that is worthwhile is what is this mind up to, and the energy of this mind continuing in a positive way and wanting to get out of these repetitive negative cycles. So then we get into the actual bodhisattva practice, now that you're kind of well prepared. And this is getting into remembering bodhicitta, that there's conventional and there's ultimate. So that's related to the conventional world or conventional reality. And then that bodhicitta, which exists in the mind of someone who's actually seen reality clearly. So conventional bodhicitta is our main project at our level, trying to really get this solid in our mind. So it's the main Mahayana motivation. Mahayana means it's referring to the great scope, or referring to seeking full enlightenment, complete Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. And it fully, when it's fully qualified, it's uncontrived and it's spontaneous. And it actually becomes a main mind, a primary consciousness, which means it's not a thought anymore. It's such a strong thought, a repetitive thought, that now it imbues your main mind and influences all other thoughts. So with repetition, a thought becomes a main mind, or a mental factor in a way transforms into a main mind. And that's incredibly powerful because it means it's there always. You don't have to stop and think about it. So it's achieved when you realize the Mahayana path of accumulation, which also depends on having renunciation. And then ultimate bodhicitta, this is this perfection of wisdom known in Sanskrit as prajnaparamita. And it's a direct, unmediated realization of emptiness that is also called ultimate bodhicitta. So it's not the direct realization of emptiness alone, rather it's the direct realization in union with bodhicitta. And the union of wisdom and method constitutes the first bhumi, or ground level, of bodhisattva attainment. So for those of you that know about the five paths, it's on the path of meditation, the first ground of the path of meditation. So in other words, ultimate bodhicitta is bodhicitta in the mind of a bodhisattva who's realized emptiness. Yeah. So just looking at the synonyms here, or relational terms, great scope equates to the Mahayana, equates to developing bodhicitta, working towards enlightenment or Buddhahood, actual practices of a bodhisattva, kind of get all those together in your mind in one grouping. And then we go into relative first. The practice of all the bodhisattvas is to arouse bodhicitta, so as to bring freedom to all sentient beings, infinite in number. For how can true happiness ever be found while our mothers, who have cared for us throughout the ages, endure such pain? So why do we use the word mothers? I'm sure some of you know. Why do we say mothers? Yeah, Pamela, go ahead.
Because everybody, every being that we encounter has at some point been our mother.
Yep. And why that relationship? Because they've all been our enemy and our meal and everything in between. Why do we pick that one?
Oh, why do we pick the relationship of mother?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm right, but I think it's because the mother enables us to survive, and or ideally sometimes other people have to intervene or other beings have to intervene, but generally speaking it's the mother who lets us get past that point of vulnerability so that we'll die and move on to live a life.
Yeah, exactly. And so here we have to remember Tibetan culture, right? And in Tibetan culture, the mother archetype is like everything. And if you ever meet Tibetan mothers, they are like mothers, like that is their identity and their job. And they are just like all in with their kids. And they're not doing it in such an attached helicopter parent way as maybe some American moms. They're just so patient. They are so patient with their kids. And you don't really see, at least traditionally, and this is a big stereotype, of course, but traditionally you don't see them yelling or putting them down or neglecting, but you also don't see them too hovering or even too validating. They're not like, oh, you're so wonderful, baby. You're so amazing, baby. They're just like love flooding them quietly, holding the space for them to learn life. And it's a really fascinating thing to observe. But when we talk about mothers in the West, of course, our relationship with our mothers is so complicated, especially because of the friction in the last 50 years of, you know, how much attention should she have on the kids and whose job is it and what is the dad up to and whatever sort of family configurations we all grew up with and divorce and working parents and, you know, capitalism, right? The patriarchy, right? So anyway, our relationships with our mothers are complex, right? And so what we're trying to remember is the mother archetype of someone who put their own needs before ours, or someone who put our needs before theirs. Freudian slip. Love you, mom. You know what I mean, right? So it's an interesting thing to explore. So sometimes if you think about some animals in the mammal realm, some mammals who are so caring to their babies. Of course, some mammals like eat their babies, so don't pick those, right? But like think of good ones, right? I don't know, dolphins or something. And even like I was thinking about this little spider that I was gonna put outside, and this spider had a little egg sac. And when I was scooping her up, she was separated from her egg sac. And she kept running back, getting out of the bucket and running back to the egg sac to save it. And I didn't understand what was happening at first until I saw, oh, it's not just a bit of dust she keeps running back to, it's actually her eggs. And then I scooped them together, and then she stayed happily in the bucket. And I took her outside with her eggs and it was fine. But I thought, wow, even the spider has that sense of must take care of babies, you know, whether it's from instinct or compassion, it is hard for us to know. But what we're thinking about is all sentient beings have been good to us at some point, even if right now they are hard work, even if right now it's been tricky, at some point all sentient beings have been good to us, and not just kind of polite and sweet, but at a time when we were incredibly vulnerable as babies, they kept us from dying. We would have died without them. And that is true of all mothers. We would have died without them at some point. Right. And so if you can kind of hang on to that, and then you look at all the sentient beings, all the people in these Zoom cubes, all the people in your real life, and think, you've been incredibly good to me and my survival has depended upon you. And in a way continues to depend upon you, because we all need each other to live. Yeah, we can't exist without other human beings. Even if we are isolated and alone and don't realize it, somebody made our house, food came from somewhere, etc., right? So this gratitude is supposed to bubble up in us to make us feel connected and relational. So if thinking of the mother just does not do that for you, think of something else that does that for you. The tricky word here is actually the word infinite, because when we say infinite sentient beings, we don't actually mean infinite sentient beings. We mean numberless, because the amount is incredibly large. So what we're trying to understand is that time is beginningless, but the amount of sentient beings are finite. Yeah, so just kind of hold that premise. It's a Buddhist premise. Time is beginningless. The amount of sentient beings is finite. There are no new sentient beings. We're all just kind of recycling and recycling and recycling. This world, other worlds, this realm, other realms, but we're not any, there's no one older than anyone else, right? We're all the same age. Interesting. But because time is beginningless and sentient beings, though incredibly vast in number, do have a limit, we've bumped into each other many times. Yeah, so that means we have all been in relationship with each other many times. So that's the logic behind it. Now, of course, scientifically, we know that miraculously they have found, you know, a beginning to the universe or the beginning of the Big Bang. And we would say there have been many Big Bangs. And I think there are some quantum physicists that agree with that as well. That sure, maybe this universe had a beginning, but there was something before that, maybe a different one. And maybe the universe kind of expands and then contracts and then expands and then contracts, maybe like a heartbeat. And Stephen Hawking could explain it to us much better if he was still alive, or maybe he has and I have to reread Black Holes and Baby Universes. But to know that that's the reasoning, and that's why we can think even strangers once wiped our bums and fed us and kept us from dying in the woods. Yeah. And that creates a sense of closeness and gratitude. And this is kind of foundational ideas for developing bodhicitta. So it's worthwhile sitting with, like, how do you feel genuinely grateful for other people without feeling like, I don't know, a guilt trip or like some sort of pressure is being imposed on you, but just a genuine, oh, thank goodness. Thank goodness I've had you all to influence the wisdom I have now and the resources I have now. Thank goodness I've had you. Does that work for you guys, or do you feel some kind of like, Yeah, you gotta sit with it, but it does change the way you live in the world if you're feeling grateful to everyone. Grateful without a guilt trip.
When I was living in China, I used to travel on the bus. And because it was a long journey of about an hour, I used to do the Lojong practice on everybody on the bus. So I used to have some beautiful trips to work and back.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great way to pass the time on the train. That's beautiful. So, you know, this then leads us to this very famous practice in Tibetan Buddhism, which is called Lojong, that turns into Tonglen, giving and taking. And this is based on the practice of exchanging oneself and others. So you're exchanging self-cherishing for cherishing others, which has nothing to do with self-neglect, right? You're not neglecting yourself. You're putting yourself in the correct perspective. Yeah. So the practice of all the bodhisattvas is to make a genuine exchange of one's own happiness and well-being for all the sufferings of others. Since all misery comes from seeking happiness for oneself alone, whilst perfect Buddhahood is born from the wish for others' good. So this is an attitude. This is a mental training. And it's, in a way, secret and private, and not something you're disclosing to other people, or even something that's happening literally in a direct way. It's something that's happening then in an indirect way. Because by adopting the attitude that I'd like to give you my happiness and take your suffering, yeah, I want to give you my happiness and take your suffering, we cannot literally do that in that exact moment. But when we adopt that attitude, we can change the atmosphere within us, which radiates out in the atmosphere that is an influence on others. And we actually do have the power to influence their conditions, and their suffering might actually go down and their happiness might actually increase. But it's something that has to start with an attitude, and it feels very counterintuitive. And it's something to do from a very stable mind that's not fallen into depression or a sense of deprivation, unless you're very well trained. And then you can use this to get yourself out of depression and get yourself out of deprivation mentality, but only if you've understood it correctly. Otherwise, you fall into martyrdom or becoming a doormat. So the way you do it, and we're going to do the meditation to just experiment. But the way you do it is to think of the benefits, first of all, of exchanging self and other. and the faults of not. And then you think about your ability to exchange self and other. If you get used to it, you can do it in small ways and build up to larger and larger ways. And then the stages of meditating on how to do the exchange, and then checking to see, have you actually developed some bodhicitta? So you make a categorical differentiation between self and other, and that's one of the obstacles. So you try and understand that self and other are actually mutually dependent. Cosmically, you think there is only a sense of self because I have a sense of other. There's a basic dualism in my thinking. And we have to remove the obstacle of thinking, I will not make an effort to dispel other suffering because other suffering does not harm me. So there's a fallacy there. It would be like not alleviating the pain in the foot from by the hand, because the foot and the hand are different. Yeah, and you know that they're a related system. So it would be, of course, logical for the hand to go soothe the foot if it hurt itself. Okay, so this equalizing and exchanging, we're going to do the meditation and just treat it really experimentally. Okay, don't feel like you need to force yourself, but it's something to explore because it can fundamentally widen your focus. So finding a good meditation posture. Do you guys need a 1-2 minute leg stretch, or are you okay to keep going? Okay, okay. Okay, so good posture. And settle. Just again, be in the body for a moment. Relax any tension that you might have developed. And revive the motivation. Sanghe churam sogi chunam nae janchu padu dani kapsuchi dagi jin sogi pe sonam gi krona penche sanghe drupasho. Sanghe churam sogi chunam ma janchu padu dani kapsuchi dagi jin sogi pe sonam gi krona penche sanghe drupasho. Sanghe churam sogi chunam la janchu padu dani kapsuchi dagi jin sogi pe sonam gi drola penche sanghe drupasho. And with that motivation, just gently shift to the breath for a couple of minutes in order to let the surface distractions settle. Or if you prefer, you can focus lower at a sensation like your feet. Just do some simple shamatha in order to settle. Staying simple, staying attentive, or returning to simplicity and attentiveness whenever you drift. And now consciously shift to analysis. Start by asking some questions about what is it to equalize? What is equality? Am I equal to sentient beings? Are they equal to me? And so think about the fact that all sentient beings, every single being with life, with consciousness, wants happiness, contentment, peace, doesn't want suffering, pain, inconvenience. It looks very different, but the underlying motivation with us all is the same. What we call happiness, what we call suffering might be different, but the drive is equal, the same. Sometimes we are skillful in achieving happiness and avoiding suffering. Sometimes we are unskillful. Sometimes we achieve it in healthy ways or unhealthy ways. But the drive is the same. Just trying to get happy, trying to avoid suffering, however we can. This is the experience of living beings. Try to feel that sameness, the truth of that. Do you agree? We are also equal in the fact that we all have an innate ignorance that gives us this illusion of separateness, this impression of dualism. All sentient beings have this experience, this confusion. And we also have a consciousness that is clear, that can comprehend, that is pretty neutral. It just has this ignorance also, and so makes mistakes. But we also all have Buddha nature, this potential to train ourselves out of suffering and out of harmfulness, to develop the mind to its utmost capacity, of compassion, of wisdom. So all sentient beings have these three. We have ignorance. We also have a clear and knowing consciousness. And we all have Buddha nature, which means that consciousness can remove the ignorance within it. And so feeling somewhat equalized, feeling somewhat the same as every sentient being. Now see if you can adopt an attitude that exchanges all of this focus and need for your own welfare to thinking of the welfare of all. Not neglecting yourself, but changing the emphasis. If 90% of the day you're thinking about your own life and needs, and 10% of the time you think of others, what if you were to swap? Maybe this self only really needs 10%. Maybe it just needs a few logistical things, a few material supports, connections, and then all the rest of the consciousness, 90%, flowing out towards others and their welfare. Would there be a benefit in doing that? And then what is the fault or the disadvantage in not doing that exchange? What has happened to the world full of sentient beings and human beings particularly who think 90% about themselves and maybe 10% about others? What has that done to the world, to our relationship with nature, and other countries, and our families and each other? To be so self-centered has actually made that self more isolated, less happy, not more. And then personally, when your mind has been open and expansive and not too worried about the self, it might have actually been a happier self, as opposed to those times when you were obsessed with trying to get yourself happy and comfortable, trying to manipulate and manufacture conditions and fix things and get organized. When you've been obsessed with this self's happiness, you probably were less happy. And so just think to yourself, may I equalize and exchange myself for others? That the practice of all the bodhisattvas is to make a genuine exchange of one's own happiness and well-being for all the suffering of others, since all misery comes from seeking happiness for oneself alone, whilst perfect Buddhahood is born from the wish for others' good. and dedicate. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that is not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. May this precious view of emptiness that is not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, the incomparably kind Supreme Tenzin Gyatso, may you have a long life and all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three sublime ones. Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And you can relax your attention. Okay. So that one is, it's a logical exercise, and it can be a little confronting, and that's useful if it is, but just to kind of think of, can I swap the intensity of the focus on the self to the greater good? And that if we were all to do that, what a world it would be, but we've got to start somewhere. So let's start with ourselves. Are there any brief questions before we call it a day?
I think Kevin had a question.
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, how do you feel? Oh, how do I feel about tough love?
Because there's something I find in Thailand. They don't believe in that at all. And you get a lot of children who have never been denied things. Like with my own son, we brought him up with that. He was an only child, and it made him much more resilient as well.
I think that tough love only works if it's actually love. Yep. That's the short answer. And if it's not, then it doesn't. Yeah, but yeah, case by case, I think you got to use your own logic, your own life experience. And sometimes it's a bit of a let's soldier on, stiff upper lip, harshness, because that's how you were brought up, and it's actually quite mean, and you could be a bit nicer and more accommodating to your kids. And sometimes it's supporting their independence and resiliency, and it's an excellent thing. So I think it's a big question, but really the main one is it actually love? Okay, then. Yeah. But it does genuinely have to be wanting their happiness. Yeah, okay, well, thanks, folks. I know it's a lot to take in a weekend, but hopefully you're finding some connection or friendship with this text. It's a beautiful text, and I hope the rest of your life is lovely. And maybe if you want, you can come next week. We're just doing Medicine Buddha practice and a little bit of explanation, but lots more meditation. And thank you very much, Land of Joy.